Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm well.
Yeah?
Yeah, but I read recently in the Star Ledger, the sort of the paper of record, that the Ryland Inn is for sale. It's sort of facing foreclosure issues.
Yeah, we had Craig on not that long ago, and he was talking to us about a couple of investors who he was hoping were going to kind of bring it back to its one time
beyond its former glory.
Glory, yeah.
People for a long time, if they thought about fine dining in New Jersey, they thought about one restaurant, which was the Ryland Inn. I think it opened a couple of years after we did.
91,
right before we did. The year before we did.
Well, Ryland Inn has been there forever.
Yeah, but
the restaurant as we know it with Craig as a partner started in 91.
Craig Shelton took over as executive chef there with a great pedigree, and he did amazing things there. It was a really wonderful restaurant. Had a lot of good meals
and
there.
Also really important to the New Jersey restaurant scene. A lot of the great changes that you've seen here in New Jersey are due in part to the Ryland Inn and showing people that you could come out here to New Jersey. You didn't have to be in New York City to have a really exceptional meal.
Well, and I think that you have, and now I think you have a number of great restaurants in New Jersey. I think that people point to Restaurant Nicholas, owned by our friend Nicholas Harari, as being, if not the best, among the best. Some folks,
sure,
thankfully, point to Stage Left as being in that category. There are some other great restaurants as well. But when Craig was considered, and I think unfairly, because there were some good restaurants that came about. I mean, we were in existence in 93 and 94, but we were a little more casual at that time.
Back then, yeah.
And I don't know, he did some great work, and, he was on the cover of Gourmet Magazine. A lot of cool stuff, but it just goes to show you the restaurant business is a very, very dangerous
proposition. It's fragile, and
yeah.
I think that's the part of it that when you look at, or when I look at a restaurant like this and seeing it fade away into oblivion, is how fragile that can be, because you can be great and the economy can turn down.
Yeah, and there's no question that Craig Shelton was and is a great chef. But let's talk about the place. The place was, at one time, for many years, considered unquestionably the best restaurant in New Jersey. There was the Ryland Inn, and then there was everything else. And here we had a sheriff's sale was scheduled for June 25th. Shelton and his businesses owe, this is according to the Ledger, $3.9 million in defaulted loans to Valley National Bank. When the inn and its grounds are assessed at $2.8 million, that's, I could see having, and they used to do a lot of weddings, and the weddings was a very expensive restaurant. It was very busy. I think that carrying $3.9 million in debt was a little aggressive, but I don't think that was crazy for the kind of business it was doing. But let's look at what happened. You had a lot of businesses change the way they do business in the year 2000.
Especially in that area of Central Jersey.
And a couple of his best customers, I'm sure, this is all conjecture on my part, were some of the large corporations that were headquarters in that area. And I know, because those businesses did some business with us, that a couple of the largest businesses in his area, and he was in a rural area, changed their buying practices and their expense account practices and said, okay, we're severely limiting, I would say probably by 90%, what we used to spend on going out to dinner. And, boy, that's a body blow that's hard to recover from.
Especially when you are, in that area, the fine dining destination it was the occasion place. It was a type of place you went to when you really wanted to entertain somebody from out of town, or you really wanted to show somebody the best of the best. That's the type of place it was.
It was an old patrician place. Had a heliport out there. Ronald Reagan was there for a fundraiser for Millicent Fenwick. By the way, I know that I've supported mostly Democratic candidates in recent life, but one of my political heroes was Millicent Fenwick. She was great. But, you know, people, I think the helipad probably got used a lot less than advertised. But to have a helipad out in front of your country inn was kind of a nice thing. And it was quite busy and quite good, but to watch that change, it's very sobering, you know, it's very, very sobering.
It is a lesson, and the lesson to be learned for the restaurant owners of you who are listening is that things can turn, and you need to be ready for changes in economic climate, and you need to be ready for, which we're experiencing right now.
Yeah, so much we're easier, but so much easier said than done, Mark.
Of course.
I mean, we've been very lucky, and, you know, people say to us all the time, so, well, how do you operate such a successful restaurant? What's your key to success? And we often say, well, you should open with very little debt, a small place with an option on the building at the dawn of the largest economic expansion in American history in a city that's about to turn around.
In a neighborhood that's about to turn around. Exactly. And maybe someone will build a $100 million hotel across the street.
Yeah, exactly. So we can take all this credit for, you know, we've had a lot of stuff thrown in our lap. I think we've made the most of it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not kid ourselves. We have had a lot of lucky breaks.
Yeah.
And, you know, Craig had this, he had a pipe burst after and throw out his electric, and he had just a lot of bad stuff that went on there. But it's interesting to see that, to see where it's gone.
I'm curious to see what the next incarnation of the inn will be. You know, if it will continue to operate as a super high end restaurant, if it will go back to being an inn. I'm curious to see what will happen to that very important part of the, you know, New Jersey dining history.
Well, the thing is, it could be. I've often looked at that place and thought, well, that would be a wonderful home for someone. It could really be a working home or a catering facility. I am surprised the one thing that, you know, he was a destination restaurant. And Stage Left is a destination restaurant. And Catherine Lombardi to a lesser extent. But, you know, people drive way far out of their way and sometimes fly to go to Stage Left for dinner. And I take that as a great compliment. But you can't live on that alone. You've got to have people who are your regular customers who, number one, come in, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, come back again.
Yeah, not
spread
being,
the word about
we're,
you.
We're not in New York City.
Yeah, but even in New York City, I think you need regulars.
Yeah, but there are tourist restaurants in New York
That's
City.
True.
There are restaurants
That's
that
true.
Exist strictly as places that the tourists go, and they've existed for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And you know, New Jersey doesn't have that same kind of tourism. You're not, you know, there is no Times Square in Lebanon, New Jersey.
Well, but the thing is, you know, you need that dining destination business if you're going to be a super high-end restaurant like Craig was and like we are. But you also need, you know, the local people who support you. And I think you need it for a number of reasons. I think it adds to the character of the restaurant, you know, to have a family. We have a family of people who come to our wine dinners and, you know, new people all the time, but there's a core of people that are always there.
Sure.
And you know, they also, you know, your waiters need to eat on Tuesday night and Wednesday night and Thursday night as well. You know,
as well as the big wedding on Saturday, and if you're only busy, and that's one of the other issues. If you don't have kind of that, if you're not well integrated into the fabric of what's going on, you can't just exist on what happens on Saturday night.
If you look at, I mean, when we do big catering jobs, we need to reach out to people who aren't normally with us, but the events are always run by our top captains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my own wedding on a Saturday night in July, we're closing Livingston Avenue, and we're going to have 300 people there, and I'm going to have 30 waiters. And 10 of those waiters don't normally work for me or work for me occasionally, but, you know, 10 or 15 of those people are our normal captains. And I think, you know, when, you know, if the economic climate were to turn where the local New Brunswick business weren't there, you know, 5 days a week, we couldn't exist on Saturdays only.
Right, absolutely not.
Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Our guest today joining us again is Frederick Kaufman. He's a professor of English at the City University of New York. He's written about American food culture and other subjects for Harper's Magazine, New Yorker, Gourmet, Gastronomica, and The New York Times. He's also author of the book A Short History of the American Stomach. He joins us again today, and we'll start off by talking about a recent article he wrote for Savour magazine called Shapeshifters.
Frederick, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So, Frederick, what's shifting shapes?
Well, it turns out that there, a lot of scientists across the United States have been working to isolate the genes in fruit and vegetables that actually control their shape. So whether they're short and squat or long and thin, they're finding out where precisely in their genetic material is that instruction.
And they're utilizing that material to change the shapes of fruit and vegetables?
Well, that's the idea. That's the idea. They've been able to do this fairly consistently with tomatoes and are now trying to take what they've learned with the tomato and utilize it in other other species. Because it turns out, for instance, that the gene they've isolated for a tomato using a number of techniques, very, very high-tech techniques, this gene that they've isolated controls the pear shape of the tomato, and they've called it ovate. There's another gene which they've isolated in the tomato, which is called the sun gene, and it controls the intense elongation of the tomato. And there's a scientist I was talking to out in the Midwest who's working in Ohio at the Agricultural Research Station out there, and her name is Esther Vandernap. And she was about to take that strand of DNA that causes the extra-long tomato and transfer it into an eggplant to see if it would also work to make an extra-long eggplant.
And one of the things that's happened, though, that's interesting, I want to point out, you know, farmers have always selected the best tomatoes for the seed for the next year.
Right. If you wanted, the farmer took the best tomato or whatever he considered to be the best tomato, be it by flavor or texture or whatever he was looking for, and he took the seeds from that tomato and he would use those seeds in order to get the genetic qualities that he was looking for.
So there's always been a certain amount of genetic consideration, genetic selection in traditional breeding, you know, in traditional breeding for quality. But we're talking about a different level of genetic manipulation here. We're talking about going into changing the DNA without breeding here. Right? We're speeding up the process quite a bit.
Well, you're absolutely right in that you've pinpointed the controversy, and scientists are coming down all over the spectrum on this. And the question is precisely as you say: for 10,000 years, we have been domesticating our fruits and our vegetables, and of course our domestic animals too. Whenever we're doing this crossbreeding and hybridization and selecting elites and then grafting and then cloning, whenever we're going through this process, we are in fact changing, transforming the DNA of the plant that we're coming up with. That's what we do. We're making we're changing the DNA. The question are the new techniques of transgenic technology completely other than everything that's come before, or are they part of a continuum? These are the questions, and what's one of the interesting things is that you're finding that a fruit shape gene, in fact, could be moved from fruit X to fruit Y and have the same effect. This might argue that it is, in fact, a sort of a continuum.
Well, it is, but I mean, when you look at manipulating things as on a DNA level, I mean, it seems like a wholesale different way of doing things, because you know, I think that people have a certain amount of faith in nature that, you know, there are breaks that can be put on, and you know, and sometimes in the past in history we felt the phylloxera virus, of course, which wasn't a virus, the phylloxera louse came across from American grapevines to European grapevines and almost decimated the European grapevines, which had no resistance to it. So nature does allow for, you know, certain really bad things to happen when people start experimenting with crossing different sorts of plants. But there's a certain amount of break that doesn't exist in the kind of genetic engineering we're talking about. I mean, if you want to take a jellyfish gene and put it in carrots to make them glow in the dark, you could conceivably do such a thing, to have a phosphorescence.
Absolutely.
So don't you think that there's a fundamental there are breaks that we're removing by going wholesale into the DNA and changing it in this way rather than through breeding?
That's the essence of the question right there. There's a professor of horticulture, his name is Jules Janik, and he works out of Purdue University, and he has made the point that we have a deep-set fear of bestiality. In other words, having sex with species beyond our own. And this is a deep-set human fear.
I have that.
Yeah, right. And what he's saying is that what we're doing with the transgenic technologies is we're actually crossing the species boundary. Of course, whenever you're using a species' natural propensity to have sex and to procreate, right, or manipulate that through hybridization and crossing, you never have a problem with the FDA. Something like that is just regulated, no question. It doesn't even have to go up for question. It's when you're doing the crossing that could not be done sexually that you have the question and the issue. Now, I should just point out for a second, though, that the world in which we're living today is different than the world we lived in 10,000 years ago, obviously, or even 100 years ago. And what I mean by that is, for instance, the disease that you're talking about. Diseases are spreading more rapidly today than they ever have in the history of the world.
You know what? We're going to have to leave it right there for just a moment, Frederick. We'll come back on the other side and pick up this argument. It's fascinating, and it really is one of the most important discussions going on in food today. And we'll continue in just a moment with Frederick Kaufman. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The maragat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're having a fascinating discussion with Frederick Kaufman, author of A Short History of the American Stomach.
Frederick, you were talking a little bit about diseases and how prolific they are in our society today.
Yeah, one of the issues in the transgenic technology, for instance, out at the UC Davis Plant Transformation Laboratory that I was visiting rather recently, is, let's say, in the wine-growing region of California, there is a disease called Pierce's disease,
sure,
which has been attacking grape arbors.
Right.
Now, in fact, what I've seen is that through transgenic technology, the technicians over there have been able to take it's kind of like an immunological idea, part of the Pierce's disease, and put it directly into the grape so that the grape would then be immune. And what's the kicker here is the way they show the marker that it actually made it to the grape gene is with a jellyfish gene that glows in the dark. So when they turn off the lights in the lab and they put on the strange Zeiss microscope, you can actually see these transgenic genes glowing in the dark. It is kind of freaky.
But you talked about this inherent fear that we have, and I'm going to be honest with you. I think that's a healthy fear. I think that we need to be careful here as we move things from one species to another, because we don't always know how they're going to integrate and react. And, you know, Francis and I talk about the genie being out of the bottle. You know, some of these things there's no returning from, because they're out in nature.
Here's maybe one other final thought, which is that people always say, well, I don't want a fish gene in my grape. But guess what? We are all salads of genes. We already have tons of fish genes in our genome.
Mm-hmm.
It actually is not as simple as I am completely different than an oyster. We share something like 2/5 of our genetic material with oysters.
You know, when we come back on the other side of the news, I want to talk about where this goes from a moral perspective that I'm not as concerned with, but I think a lot of folks are.
Well, it's a moral perspective.
Well,
Why would you be concerned?
No, funny. It's you know, sort of the God question of things, and I also want to delve a little further into the genie out of the bottle thing. I think there's a hubris question as well. Or maybe I'm just a scaredy cat. But we'll talk about more about this with Frederick Kaufman. His book is A Short History of the American Stomach. He's a prolific author on American food. You can find out more about him and his book at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And we'll talk more about this after the news, so stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today our guest is Frederick Kaufman. He returns. We're talking about an article he's written recently for Savoir magazine called Shapeshifters, about genetic engineering of crops. His wonderful book is A Short History of the American Stomach. Before the break, we were talking about genetic engineering, not breeding, but genetic engineering of crops. One of the questions that folks raise is when we start messing with the genetics of crops, when we really are creating new forms of life. And I think a lot of folks, myself included, would I hate that cowardly argument. Some people say that, you know, I think when we create a new form of life, there are all sorts of questions that are raised by genetic engineering. You know, if you create a new animal, horse, donkey, mule is one thing. You know, horse, salmon, seahorse, you know, is something very different. Now, obviously, it takes on even the ramifications, I think, become more exaggerated when you talk about animal life. But when we create things that then go out into the environment and can reproduce and can get away from us, there is genetically modified corn that may be doing a great deal of damage to the monarch butterfly. Well, guess what? It's out there, and there's no way to get it back.
Or to honeybees.
I think that there is an argument to be made, though certainly a lot of good can be done from genetic engineering, that maybe it's a little hubristic to think, you know, we've got it, now I can release this new form of life I've created into the environment.
Yeah, you know, I do not want to be the great apologist for genetically modified foods, and I think, of course, that the number one concern for everybody involved in this business in any way, shape, or form is, of course, safety. Biosafety, creating the frankenfruit, creating the invasive species. Of course, strangely enough, that has not been the major problem with this. I mean, there have been plenty of problems. That's not it. The invasive species problem is much more apt to happen through species traveling around the globe. I think you're absolutely right also about the whole issue of hubris, but I also look at it from the opposite perspective, which is that I think we all need to have a little bit more humility about our own DNA, in the sense that we understand that we are all mixes. That, you know, we talk about we're all brothers and sisters. Well, we're brothers and sisters with the plants and the animals too. We share so much of this DNA with them. So on a certain level, what we're doing here is asserting our brotherhood and sisterhood through this. We're just saying, you know, we can use this from this and this from that. We also have to realize that with climate change, with higher salinity and water levels, with greater global warming, with greater carbon dioxide levels, a lot of the scientists I'm talking to are telling me we need to be able to change and domesticate our crops more quickly than in the past. That we can't just walk around generation through generation through generation. You know, it took something like 500 years to domesticate corn, right? The idea is when things are changing more quickly now in our environment, with disease moving around much faster, with the global spread of things, we need to be able to react more quickly, and we need to use the technologies at hand in a safe way.
But now, that's where I just need to interject for a moment,
yeah.
and we're talking about hubris here. There's so much of this that we have yet to understand.
Well, that's absolutely right. The point is that the other point is that technology has gotten us into this pickle. I don't think there's any question that, you know, we're looking at the food supply, how many people, there are 6.5 billion people on Earth, right? There are something like 853 million of them do not have enough to eat. This is a problem, and I'm not saying that genetic modification is going to be the answer, but I think we're in such a position now that we have to keep it on the table. All the people I'm talking to who are experts, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa, the populations that are living on less than a dollar a day, the people who are really starving, these are the people who they say, you know, we need to keep genetic modification at least on the table of things that we're considering, because this could conceivably save hundreds of millions of people. Conceivably.
Well, you know, that's interesting. But there's also the argument out there that it's you know, there's plenty of food on the planet. It's just a matter of distribution. I mean, we have American food, and now it's being used for biofuels. But for a long time, we had American food. We paid farmers not to farm part of their land.
And Europe too. There are still vast European farm subsidies. You know, the problem. There are so many questions. It's such an extraordinarily complicated question. You're absolutely right. I'm going to head to Rome, June 3rd to 5th. The UN has a big conference there on global food security. You know, with, of course, the commodity prices are spiking. We have this worldwide drought. We have riots in more than 30 countries, food riots. You know, these are huge questions, and they have to be solved fairly immediately. And, of course, we also know that so much of the Green Revolution of the 70s depended on just pouring oil, in other words, chemical fertilizers and diesel to plow fields, into the earth so
right.
that we could increase our yield. Of course, we don't have those same options today.
Right.
One other thing I just wanted to point out from the strictly religious perspective, and a lot of the scientists I talk to actually, oddly enough, believe in God and point this out, which is that if you do, if you are going to accept, let's say, the book of Genesis,
mm-hmm.
On the third day, the great Lord gives human beings dominion over the fields. And this, the idea then becomes, it has been our job. It has been our job for thousands and thousands of years to manipulate the fields, to make things grow out of it that didn't ordinarily grow out of it. In many other cultures, agriculture is seen as a blessing. Only in the Christian Jewish tradition is it a curse. Adam is cursed as he leaves the Garden of Eden, that he must toil on the soil. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's also interesting from the whole perspective of kosher, in the sense that the laws of kosher are very clear. A genetically modified organism is kosher. It just is, because
what are the rules of kosher as they apply to genetically modified organisms?
Yeah, you're about to educate me.
Yeah,
here,
you got two Catholic boys sitting here.
Well, you haven't read all the chapter on genetic modification.
I have the Old Testament, but I missed that part.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was talking to Rabbi Ganak, who is the head of the Orthodox Union. They're the largest kosher certifiers in America. And I had the same question to him. The point is that in the book of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, where the kosher laws are stated explicitly,
mm-hmm.
there is no mention of the things, you know, the things that aren't mentioned.
Oh,
kosher.
Aren't prohibited. Oh,
that's right. And they didn't prohibit them. And there you have it. They've switched it around. Anything that's genetically modified is by its very nature kosher.
So hold on a second. If I have a genetically modified cow, I then milk that cow and make a cheeseburger from that cow.
Well, that's not going to be kosher, obviously.
Well, what the heck?
that's a trick question. Or, for instance, you know, a chromosome-whacked oyster, you know, which you see a lot of. A lot of the oysters out there have been transformed so that they don't have two chromosomes but three. Well, an oyster is an oyster and is still not going to be kosher.
Right, still prohibited.
You bet.
That's interesting. Well, you know, the other topic, and I'm not a strictly religious person, so I don't. You know, say this contravenes my Bible when I talk about, you know, us acting, you know, playing God. I think that I am very concerned in altering life in this very fundamental way. And another large concern I have is that the way we've set up our laws, once something is manipulated on a genetic level, that new genetic information can be patented.
Can be owned by somebody.
And so now you have a form of life that's owned, and not just that tomato, or not just the progeny of that tomato, but any tomato that has that genetic information, and it can now be owned by a large corporation.
And not only that, but any tomato or plant or anything that is created using those procedures, you're going to have to pay a royalty. It's
right.
Not just the actuality of the product. It's the way you get there that has to be licensed. A lot of the scientists feel very uneasy about the nature of the patent laws today. And in fact, a lot of those patent laws are blocking scientific progress.
Oh, sure.
Because if there's enough, you know, if there are too many royalties and too many licenses, you're just not going to go there. It's too expensive, particularly when there's not a lot of money to go around in scientific research anyway, I mean, it's highly problematic. I think that those patent laws are going to have to change and go back to the way they were in the 1970s, where you could not have a patent forever on one tiny little thing. So, for instance, Monsanto is the classic example of this. They have a patented soybean. And then they patent those seeds, right? Those soybean seeds.
Exactly.
Now, the soybean seed, right, if you look at the genome of it, is this extraordinarily, incredibly complicated thing. And you can imagine it as a pile of dimes reaching from the floor to maybe 6 feet in the air. Okay? Well, what Monsanto has done is they've taken their own little dime that they've created and put it on top of the pile, and they say, okay, now the whole thing's mine.
Right, the whole pile is mine.
Right.
Well, listen, I know when these patent laws are going to be challenged. They're going to be challenged when something that Monsanto creates gets into something that DuPont creates, and DuPont and Monsanto have it out.
And I'll also tell you when this whole argument about genetically modified food is going to be moot. And that's when we start getting really hungry.
Well, you know, when I don't know that I agree with you, but I can't wait to continue the conversation, so stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Frederick Kaufman. The conversation has gone down the road of talking about genetic modification. So that is in postscript what today's show is about. It's been a lot of fun. One of the things that we talk about, or that the case law has shown with genetic modification, is when things are genetically modified by a company, that company then owns that life form, and anybody else who makes something that looks like that life form, and anything that DNA turns up in. And so what the case law has found in Canada and the United States is, you know, if someone is growing a genetically modified tomato in his backyard or farm across from mine, and there's some cross-pollination that takes place, and some of that genetically modified material winds up in my next generation of tomatoes or zucchinis or whatever, Monsanto has a right to demand a royalty from me, even though they have a patent on the genetic information in my tomato, even though it was carried by a bee onto my yard.
And not a genetically modified bee.
That's also very troubling. I think you're right, Frederick. The patent laws are extremely. It's a new area of patent law.
It's patently absurd.
Yeah, of course
that the bee would be part of this this lawsuit, and that you would owe them a royalty. I think the other thing that's interesting in this regard is it maybe even widens the argument, is that it's not only the Monsanto seeds that have been patented. You know, the fruits and vegetables that we eat are not really what we think they are. When we go to the supermarket and we see the carrots, what you're looking at there is the superstar carrot. You're looking at the variety of carrot, of all the other varieties of carrot that have made it through to this stage. You're looking at Kobe Bryant. You're not
right.
looking
right,
right, you know,
right.
And as you walk through the supermarket aisle in the fresh produce section, you're looking at an all-star team. These are the ones that have made it. And you know what? They are all highly specific varieties that people do own intellectual property rights to. People at Cornell, people at Texas A&M, they have different, the raspberry is owned by somebody, the strawberry.
Yeah, we only have one banana in our supermarket right now.
Well, the Cavendish banana is a little bit distinct. I mean, in fact, it's interesting to bring that one up because it has such a disease possibility and problem. And in fact, a lot of the scientists are working very hard to get some wild banana gene into the Cavendish dessert banana to give it some sort of immunity, because they say that the Cavendish banana is one virus away from annihilation on the globe, right? It's the story's been around for a while. So the question is, how do we solve that problem? How do we domesticate or transmute a gene which is going to help that banana into it? This one banana, the Cavendish banana, I believe is a variety that comes out of China in 1820, and we're eating clones of it. Just for instance, people don't realize that almost all the fruits and vegetables they're eating are hybrids and clones. They're all cloned. Apples are cloned.
I also want to point out that there is a difference in the way that the copyright and the patent and the trademark laws apply to agriculture. It used to be that you could not own a patent on life, on a living thing. Now, if you were a breeder, you could own what you bred through one generation, but then the patent didn't hold forth any further.
And basically, I mean, if you're breeding horses, or just to simplify the argument a little bit, you would own the sperm from your horse that you passed along, but then it would no longer be yours, and the next generation would own that horse.
And the way the patents work now is that genetic information can be patented so that for all of human existence, farmers have been able to take part of their crop and take the seeds from that crop and plant it for next year. And with the laws the way they've changed, it's illegal for them, even if they take the seeds from their own crop to plant for next year, they still have to pay a royalty to Monsanto or to whomever owns that patent. And that's just, again, patently absurd.
And the law is going to have to change, I believe. I mean, if we think about the origins of the Plant Patent Act, it goes back to 1930. That is when the U.S. passes its first Plant Patent Act. Why do they pass such a thing? The idea is to protect the intellectual creator of a property, just like the author of a book or you guys who, you know, have some sort of intellectual property right to this radio show as it's going on, so not everybody can just pick it off and use it for their own ends. That was the idea with the Plant Patent Act of 1930, is to say these people who are working in horticulture, particularly people like Luther Burbank, who at that time had created, you know, 20 or 30 new varieties of fruits and vegetables, give him some credit for him and give him some incentive. In other words, it's kind of a capitalistic idea.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You will have your incentive, and you will have a right to it. The way it is now, it's being completely twisted and exploited by very large companies like Archer Daniels Midland or Monsanto or Brazil's Bunge Corporation that is doing the same thing down below the border.
Well, it just goes to show that we need to be more aware of how our food is produced and what's going on, and that's why you need to read articles by Frederick Kaufman. You need to pick up his book called The Short History of the American Stomach, and you need to listen to this radio show. Frederick, it was wonderful to have you back on the
show.
Frederick,
it's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back in just a moment. You can pick up The Short History of the American Stomach by looking on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. That was a really wonderful discussion.
Well, obviously a very intelligent guy who's really thought out his platform. Really thought.
You're talking about me?
No, I'm talking about Frederick Kaufman, obviously.
Oh, sorry. I figured. Well, no, you know, but the thing is, look, we have on this show, I guess it's self-regulating thing, and I agree with Frederick Kaufman on a lot of what he's written. He's written a lot of really good stuff. But, you know, I think we disagree on the necessity or the wisdom of genetically modifying crops.
Well, you know what, and this is, I said the same thing about ethanol 3 years ago. Okay, and how I feel about genetic modification is, I think that it's something that we need to explore, that we need to better understand. But genetic modification is a science that once we release it out into nature, you can't pull that back. If we've made a mistake, if we send something out, if smashing jellyfish into grapes makes all the jellyfish glow, the grapes glow.
Well, let's talk about a real example. Let's talk about something a lot more humble. And I think that the possibility of what can be done is truly tremendous or horrific, depending on how you want to look at it.
Right.
But again, when we create a new life form that goes out into the environment, it's truly unstoppable. And if you look at what happens when we have genetically modified salmon that are raised in fish farms, well, guess what? A couple of them escape.
Right. They do. They just escape.
Now, usually, they don't last more than a generation out into the wild, because the ones that we've genetically modified don't tend to last more than a generation. But they're bigger than the regular salmon. Mm-hmm. They outcompete the regular salmon for food and for mating. Now, they generally wind up not to have very successful rates of progenating.
Thus far.
But they could. So what happens when, you know, we're one step away from, okay, we, you know, a couple always escape. Mm-hmm. That's the thing about nature. You know, you raise a million salmon, you can't say, okay, well, none will ever escape. It's stupid.
Right.
And so what's going to happen when, you know, two or three salmon, and that's really all it takes, who can procreate and are successful procreators, get out there and outcompete the native salmon for food.
What the genetic modification argument would be is that who cares? That this is just a we're speeding up the process.
But you don't know what the thing that man creates can do, and mm-hmm. what the havoc that can be wrought, the level of mistake that we can make is much greater with genetic modification than it is with simple breeding. And mm-hmm. there are breaks put on the process by nature, and I think maybe we should respect those breaks. Just because we can go without them, I don't think we need to.
That's how I feel.
Anyway, well, I'm sorry. It's kind of unfair to Frederick to have continued the argument without him. Maybe we should call him back and get him on again.
I'm sure we will.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have here with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.